गुड गुड। हेलो शौकत, क्या हाल है? मसूद, हाउ आर यू?
चलो जी, गुड।
गिव अस अनदर 2 मिनट्स जस्ट टू मेक श्योर दैट वी गॉट नो स्ट्रगलर्स लेफ्ट बिहाइंड। वी विल स्टार्ट इन लिटरली 2 मिनट्स, नो मोर। ही इज वेटिंग विद बेटेड ब्रेथ, सो इट शुड बी गुड टू स्टार्ट ऑन। सो ये क्या किया है मंसूर? स्क्रीन शेयरिंग तो ऑन करें
सर। करता हूँ एक मिनट सर, आपके लिए आप राइट्स दे रहा हूँ सर। जी सर, ऑन हो गई।
ओके ओके फोक्स, I think this has been our series stabilization. We're going to have more of these. We're going to have one on Wednesday, Adnan Mazrai, who used to work with Masood, and more in future. But today, I'm very grateful to Masood Ahmed and Shaukat Tareen. Both of them have agreed to participate in this webinar, which, as you all know, is very important for Pakistan. Pakistan is doing some decades of struggle with stabilization. Masood Ahmed has been the president, is currently the president of Center for Global Development, and has been the director for the Middle East Department of the IMF, the department that used to be in charge of Pakistan. So Masood Ahmed, I think, directly was kind of, well, responsible for the last two programs. But we're not going to talk to him just in the fund program. We're going to talk to him on a broader set of things. He's going to tell us about how Pakistan can really dig itself out of the hole that we have. And here, I just want to put this forward, that bit of housekeeping. This is the first in the series, as I said. Please keep your mics mute, because otherwise you get a lot of background noise. Let the speakers speak first. Then, of course, everybody can raise their hand and ask any question you like. We believe in an open forum. We allow everybody to speak and make their comments. Everybody will have a chance, so don't worry. It's not as if you'll be left out. And but we don't like a debate on TV where everybody starts talking against each other. So we want to be a little bit more orderly, and we do get that kind of behavior. And anybody wants to use Twitter, hashtag PIDEIMF. So let's go forward and see. Well, this is the history of Pakistan with the IMF. As you can see, there hasn't been a decade when we haven't used the IMF. IMF is like the emergency ward of the world. And can you imagine a country there or a person who's permanently in the emergency ward? Well, we have been permanently in the emergency ward. Almost every decade since the 1960s, we've been with the IMF. It's a long-term issue. We've taken $53 billion, but you know, there you are. That's where we are. This is the cartoon that media depicts, where the great IMF, the big body there, is running Pakistan. Pakistan running after loans, and the conditions are right there. So that kind of depicts what we where we are right now. This happens with every prime minister, every even martial law. They keep running after the IMF. They keep running after loans, and we never get anywhere. That's a problem. So heavy reliance on IMF and donors. In the prolonged use report, there was a report done by the IMF internal evaluation in the prolonged use. There were three things, Masood, that they raised. They raised that there were design failures as far as Pakistan was concerned. There were implementation failures as far as the government was concerned. And that institutional decay had taken place. Since then, a new term has been added, austerity. And I'd like you to reflect upon that. Now, the problem is that we have a deep capacity issue, both in the FPR, Ministry of Finance, planning, everywhere. And our tax policy is absolutely a disaster, as we might talk about it. And we have talked about it in our previous webinars. The last program, we had a number of waivers. This has been the record in almost all programs, but let's take the last program. We also appreciated the exchange rate during the program. We lost reserves during the program. We built up debt during the program. The program didn't even last 3 months. After the IMF gave us a good health report in September 2016, we started experiencing the exchange rate program a problem, and we almost quickly returned to the IMF. Meanwhile, we have increased our energy prices, but our circular debt doesn't go away. So energy sector is a mess. So the question is, when will we have a durable adjustment and how? And what are the objectives of our economic? Meanwhile, our long-run growth rate is declining. And this is very evident from the chart that you can see here. Our long-run growth is declining. Our investment rate is also declining and very low, the lowest in Asia. So are we really achieving anything by our economic policy? Our tax documentation, this whole regime that we built up, is happening at the cost of growth and employment. Investment is declining, GDP is declining, and it's a huge burden on the economy. Investment is dying. Fiscal deficit still remains high. We've had about 30 programs, and fiscal deficit still remains now, well, it was before the corona, it was about 8%. Now it's going to be probably 12%. But yeah, corona is responsible, but the fiscal deficit is high before the corona too. So the question is austerity, especially after the Greek program. If you read Voufarkis' book, Adults in the Room, you'll see that Pakistan is practicing major austerity. We have no room for any operational maintenance, investment, or capacity building. So all we do is pay salaries in our budget. Now, question is program design. Does it change? Will we continue to chase revenues? Every program, we are chasing revenues while our economy is going down. Growth has collapsed. So what is the durable adjustment path, Masood? And how can we get to growth? How can we have growth with stabilization? That, ladies and gentlemen, is a very brief setting of the issue that I want before we go on to dealing with Masood. And let's hear what Masood has to say. And then, of course, Shaukat, who has been, Shaukat Tareen, nobody needs an introduction to Shaukat Tareen. He's been our finance minister. He's a very well-known personality in Pakistan. He was responsible, most important achievement of his, he was responsible for restructuring Habib Bank and making it privatizable. And Shaukat is definitely a man with strong opinion and strong analysis. So I think we'll end for a very good debate. Masood, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nadeem. Thank you for setting the stage. Thank you for organizing this. I had been hoping to present this in person at the conference you were planning to do, but now we're going to be doing this in this manner, which is the way in which we're doing a lot of interaction these days. I also want to say I'm very happy that Shaukat Tareen is here, and he's going to offer his views. I had an opportunity to work directly with him, and he's a man that I have a great deal of respect for, and I really look forward to his views. I also want to encourage other people that are on the call to offer their comments and questions, because I think the issues that you've raised are deep issues that require a lot of debate and a lot of discussion. I want to, in my brief presentation, really try and put the Pakistan story of stabilization a bit in the context of the international experience. Now, how different is it? What lessons can we draw from the efforts to stabilize economies around the world? And what does that tell us about the relationship between stabilization and growth? And I want to cover a few areas in my presentation. And if you look at the next slide, I want to start really by talking about stabilization efforts today. And we may not think of it in the same way, but there is a major stabilization effort now underway in response to a shock that has come from coronavirus. And then I want to talk a little bit about what has actually been the experience of IMF-supported programs around the world. As you mentioned, I had the opportunity to work with IMF programs for a number of years. And what have we learned from that experience around the world? And how does the Pakistan experience compare? And then really to end on this point that I think you've raised, which is what are the true drivers of growth? And, you know, we tend to believe that it's a lot of it is reforms, structural reforms. You need political will, you need ownership, you need investment and saving. But do we really have a very good recipe, or do we know how well these things interact to deliver sustained growth? So that's what I want to end on by posing that question. So let's look actually at what's happening now. And I mean, maybe just kind of a brief point, really a reminder that, frankly, the only reason you want to stabilize an economy is because the situation that you're in, you think is unstable. So nobody wants to have a stabilization program as an objective. You only have to have it because you feel that you're either in a situation of instability or because you are threatened with a instability that is going to extract major costs, and so you try to stabilize. And of course, stabilization can be symmetric. And if you look at the next slide, what you see is that you can, in today's world, what we're seeing is a stabilization effort that is trying to increase aggregate demand in the face of this unanticipated, unprecedented shock and the collapse that has happened in demand and in output. So all the response programs are working to support to stabilize the economy rather than allow it to become smaller in the face of this shock. But traditionally, most of our stabilization programs have really been about overheating. Now, you know, just to give a couple of figures on the current response, it sort of dwarfs a lot of the stabilization that has gone the other way. I mean, just think about the size of the fiscal stimulus that the rich countries of the world are putting in at the moment to try and counter the economic impact of coronavirus. And these are fiscal packages that are 10 to 15% of GDP. And of course, the big issue right now is that the emerging markets also, and the low-income countries also, have the same shock. They need also the same kind of fiscal stimulus and counter-response packages, but they can neither go and print the money from their central banks, nor can they go out and borrow money from capital markets. So their ability to respond is very much constrained by the kind of support they are able to get from official finance agencies, notably the World Bank, regional banks, the IMF, and there is part of this package is debt relief that has been agreed on bilateral debt. So all of this is sort of attempts to provide some space to the developing countries to respond. But you could also look to the fact that in fact all of these things really don't add up to what is needed. So today, I think a big issue is that there is a glaring gap between the kind of fiscal stimulus and response packages that you see in rich countries themselves compared with the kind of response that you see in terms of their ability to support the rest of the world. And this is happening at a time and in the face of a crisis where intellectually we all understand that you can't solve the COVID epidemic in any part of the world until you have solved the problem and eradicated and contained it everywhere, because the virus does not know any boundaries. So that's one kind of stabilization. But today I want us to focus really on the other kind of stabilization, which is, if you go to the next slide, you'll see that traditionally, the stabilization programs, particularly the ones the IMF has supported, and sometimes without the support of the IMF, they start off because there are imbalances in the macro framework, either on the fiscal account or more often on the external account, reserves are running down. And so the purpose of these programs has been to restore macro stability by reducing these deficits. How do they do that? They essentially try to work on the exchange rate. So that alters the relative price of exports and imports, makes imports more expensive, and encourages people in theory to export. And they try to contain aggregate demand by acting on fiscal policy and cutting back spending, monetary adjustment, so you tighten credit, raise interest rate. And the idea is that you reduce aggregate demand. And as a result, you create the conditions for a resumption of sustainable growth. So that's the basic design of all of these programs. And in effect, slowing down the economy is built into the design of the program, because that is how they're trying to restore stability. Now, if you go to the next slide, I want to show you now four slides which say, well, that's all very fine in the design, but how do they do? What's the outcome? And the IMF, actually I found last year, produced a document which was a review of all of their programs in terms of their outcomes. And what they try to do in this document, which is available on the IMF website, and which I found quite interesting to read in preparation for this presentation, is that they look at the program and they compare what were the outcomes 3 years after the program started compared with the projections that were made at the time of the program. So on different variables, how did the actual program turn out in relation to what was projected? And if you look at each of these charts, the greens, this is a distribution of the error or the differences between the actuals and the projected values. And the further away from the center you are, the greater is the difference. If it's in red, it means that the actuals were worse than the projected. And if it's in green, then it means that the actuals were better than were projected. And so if you look at it in terms of the current account, by and large, you know, what you see from this is that in all the programs, this covers all the programs the IMF has done in many, many countries. If you look at that, what you see is that on the current account, you know, some countries do worse, some do better, but by and large, more countries end up 3 years later with better current account outcomes than had been projected. Okay, fair enough. Now we look at the next picture that you'll see that they put up on imports, and you see that actually in some cases the green is means that the actuals were better, that import volume where there was more adjustment, there was more import compression, and so imports fell more in many cases, and again they're sort of evenly spread, but on balance, I guess, looking at this distribution, I would say that import compression happened more than they had thought. So current account improved, import went down. And then if you look at the next one, you look at foreign exchange reserves. And again, you see that on balance, some countries, the reserves didn't grow as much as they'd anticipated. But in quite a few, they did. So it's a sort of fairly, you know, they came out where they had projected. Now, remember, this is the difference between the projected and actual outcomes. This is not the actual, this is not a distribution of the how they did. It's a distribution of how well they did in relation to what they were projecting. And they show that there's no real error in projection here. And of course, in all of these cases, as you would imagine, they were projecting significant improvements in reserve outcomes, significant improvements in current account outcomes. So essentially, they sort of achieved what they had projected, is the way I interpret these distributions from the various programs. But in the one area, if you look at the next slide, where IMF programs didn't do as well as they projected, and this really is the core point that we will come to now, is that in their projections of growth 3 years later, generally turned out to be way too optimistic. So in many more countries, the outcomes on growth 3 years later were worse than were projected in the program. And in some cases, you know, they were between 2 to 4% of GDP worse, and actually, you know, in almost a third of the countries, they were at least 2% points of GDP worse in growth outcomes. So my summary from reading this set of slides and from their that report that goes with it, and it's an interesting report worth reading if you have the time, is that the programs turn out to be more or less as anticipated, as projected in terms of current account outcomes, but they don't do so well on growth, and on in general, 3 years down the road, growth is not as strong as the recovery that has been projected in IMF programs. And then, of course, that leads us to the obvious question, why is that? And if you go to the next slide, well, I think there are probably, you can think of three different reasons why growth outcomes turn out to be worse than people, than the IMF and countries themselves project when they start a program. The first one is that they underestimate the impact of the fiscal and monetary policies that they undertake. So, you know, when they compress demand, they thought it would have less of an impact than it did. And this issue really became very prominent in the discussions around European adjustment programs, where there was a projection of what the multiplier would be, the multiplier being the impact of a 1% cutback in, say, fiscal on aggregate output. And it turned out that the multipliers were, in fact, larger. So the IMF and the countries had underestimated how much of an impact that fiscal contraction would do in terms of growth. So, and it also turns out that now there is much more work that tries to understand what is the size of the multiplier, how it varies depending on the initial conditions, how it varies depending on what's happening in the world economy at the same time. So I think perhaps it was a little bit simplistic approach to thinking about multipliers, and now people recognize that you have to look at the design of fiscal policy much more. The second reason why growth outcomes may not turn out to be as good is because, you know, quite frankly, you might overestimate how much of an impact on growth the structural reforms that you are supporting under that program actually have. And then I'll come back to this point, because I think there's now a very big debate also in the economist profession about whether we truly understand what policies have a growth dividend, and do we fully understand how that dividend varies from country to country. Come back to this. And the third point is that maybe actually the programs, the reforms that were proposed that would cause the lead to the improvement in growth didn't get implemented. And I know from personal experience that this is often the case in many countries, that the stabilization happens, but the reforms, the structural reforms that are also part of the program aren't fully implemented. And if you look at trying to answer that question, you go to the next slide, and actually you can go to the next one after that. But covered that point, let's go to the next and say, well, what are these structural reforms, you know, that they're trying to include in these IMF programs? And we talk a lot, we use the term structural reform, and I'm not very fond of the term, because I think, you know, it covers a plethora of things. And as you can see here, you know, it can cover anything from institutional reforms to public enterprise reform to pricing in the energy sector, labor market reforms. So everything and anything, you know, is sort of like covered in there. And then let's drill down and say, well, in practice, what were these reforms? And this is a kind of interesting chart, which basically shows what are the structural reforms that are covered in IMF programs as conditions. So what is the structural conditionality? Where does it fall? What are the areas in which it falls? And as you can see, the bulk of it is around fiscal. Fiscal in terms of public financial management, public in terms of resource allocation issues, spending choices. So a lot of structural conditions around that. There's a sort of smaller set that is around financial sector and then around central banking issues, so about central bank independence, laws related to central bank, and then around state enterprise reforms. Quite a lot around public enterprises. So this is, if you like, the snapshot of what the IMF programs actually focus on when they talk about structural conditions. And then we come to the question, okay, this is all very nice in the design, but in practice, do they get implemented? And if you look at the next slide, again, this is a part of that same report of last year. They sort of look at it, and the bottom line is that, you know, they have about the same number of conditions as they used to have many years ago, a decade ago, but only half of them are actually implemented on time. So part of the explanation clearly is that you know, a lot of programs start off well, but then they go off track. But I don't think that all of the answer is implementation. I think there's also the other 2 points, which is that they underestimate the size of the fiscal and monetary multiplier, and that there's also an issue of whether we overestimate or don't really fully understand how much of an impact on growth comes from the reforms that are supported under any such program. So now this is all very general, you know, looking at the world. And I want to just show you quickly 3 slides about Pakistan, and then we can talk about that. And if you look at IMF programs, I took the last two and then the current one. So what happens immediately when a program starts? And if you compare so the period before a program starts with the period after, so it's a short period of within 1 year, you look at what happens in a program, what you discover is that in the case of 2019 and this last year, and in the case of 2009, essentially the immediate adjustment, the improvement in the current account is driven, almost dominated by a cutback in it. So it's really an import compression in the near term that leads to an improvement in the outcomes. And in the 2013 program, you have a somewhat different picture where there isn't much of an improvement overall in the current account balance, and it's actually driven a lot by remittances that were underpinned that immediate improvement. You remember that at that time there was a big increase in remittances. This is the sort of near short term. But let's look, you know, we were talking about 3 years later. What happens 3 years later? This is a slightly complicated chart, so I'm sorry about that. But essentially what it attempts to do is to show that for GDP, current account, for exports and reserves, under the last two programs, what was the projected outcome 3 years down and what was the actual outcome? And for the current program, the issue really is what is the projected outcome for 3 years down? We don't obviously yet have what the actuals are going to be. And, you know, I think if you look at this chart, what struck me is that on growth in Pakistan, outcomes were worse in the first program, kind of more or less the same next time around. But consistently, where the programs 3 years down failed to achieve what they had projected is on exports and on the reserves numbers. And in both of these cases, in the case of reserves, there's an immediate improvement, but as Nadeem mentioned in the introduction, you know, then halfway through, you begin to see some deterioration. And on exports, consistently, the projections just are way out of line with what turns out to be the reality. And you know, we can have a discussion about whether that is actually just an issue of implementation, or in a way it's a design failure, because if consistently you keep projecting that 3 years down the road, you'll have an outcome that history has shown you you can't achieve without major changes, you have to wonder whether that's a realistic projection. And if you look at the current program, I do worry a little bit that the projections that we have there for exports 3 years down will be difficult to achieve on the basis of history and on the basis of initial performance. But hopefully we will do better than we did last time. And just let me end with one slide here, which is, you know, let's take a long view. You know, if you look at this, these numbers are slightly different, but they show the same trend because this includes services, not just merchandise export. But if you look at these numbers, you know, what I see here is basically that, you know, there's a steady increase in remittances over the last 15 years. There's kind of financed a steady increase in imports, and basically export numbers kind of more or less stay in the same band. They go up a little, they come down a little. Every time you have an IMF program, if you superimpose IMF programs on this, you'll see that bits where the imports come down dramatically. But nothing much happens over this period to really changing the ability of the economy to earn its way through exports. And you know, remittances have sort of bailed us out. And big question now, of course, that we face is, we can talk about this, which is, you know, not just the immediate crisis of coronavirus, which will have a big impact on remittances near term, but what is going to be the business model and globalization after it. That's maybe a separate seminar, but I think we should have a discussion about what does that mean for the medium-term prospects for a country like Pakistan in terms of a global economy that will be very different than it has been in the last 15 years. And then perhaps just to end on one slide, which is a little bit of a kind of striking peaks and valleys slide. You know? So this is basically just showing what happens to reserves in Pakistan. And as Nadeem, I think, very rightly said, that there are two points I want to make about this. One is that, you know, every time a program starts, you start building up reserves, because that's the objective of the program. And but this process, so as I mentioned earlier, then after the initial drop in imports, you start sort of increasing imports again. And 3 years or so into it, sometimes a bit less, we sort of run out of steam, and our ability to contain imports becomes harder. Political pressures increase, and so we start to increase imports and start running down reserves. And that leads us over a fairly predictable cycle to the next point, where our reserves have fallen to the level where we again need to stabilize the economy, and then the whole cycle starts again. And the yellow line, which is actually a point that Nadeem made to me a year or maybe even longer ago, and which I think is a very important point, that one strange thing, and I do think this is a strange thing about the implementation during an IMF-supported program, is that the real effective exchange rate actually appreciates during the course of IMF program. And, you know, in a way, it sort of starts off with the incentive structure. Incentive to have exporters come in, but very quickly then it... over the course of the period, the real effective exchange rate starts appreciating, and that, as we all know, has an impact on the relative attractiveness of exporting versus importing. So just to conclude, my key takeaway from looking at all of these stabilization programs, including the ones in Pakistan, is the stabilization programs do more or less what they're expected to do, which is to stabilize the economy. But the track record of stabilization programs in terms of laying the foundations of any sustained structural growth at a higher level is much less successful, not just in Pakistan, but I would say more generally. And then you get into this discussion of what will growth come from. And, you know, I would just end by saying perhaps a couple of more general observations about the time I've spent working with various people in government in Pakistan and elsewhere also, but let me focus on Pakistan, which is, you know, the main problem of having these repeated bouts of stabilization is that they really take us away from what is a much more important conversation, which is about how do you deal with the obstacles or the policies, the action that will get us to a sustainably higher growth rate. Finance ministers in Pakistan, precisely because of that first chart that Nadeem put up, finance ministers in Pakistan spend way too much time managing the books and the near term, you know, worrying about the next quarter and balancing the books for the next quarter than they should. Because what that comes at is the expense of dealing with having a high level conversation and a high level consensus that is a cross-party, cross-political consensus on the economic strategy that is a 10 or 20 year process to actually see countries steadily make improvements and find their way in the world economy. And, you know, you can do many, many charts that will show how we have fallen behind other countries over the last 20 years in terms of growth rate. Our growth rate has been declining, but also our position in world markets has been declining in many areas. But every time we start to have a conversation about it and we have to make some difficult decisions, whether it's about closing down on uneconomic public enterprises or investing in strategically in some other areas, or we get distracted because we run out of bandwidth and time and space because we have to then deal with the next stabilization bout, and everybody starts focusing on that. And the IMF, you know, the IMF should have a much less regular role in a country like Pakistan that it does, precisely because we want to move away from this distraction of repeated stabilization. And I Shaukat Tareen is going to discuss this now. And I would say that, you know, one thing that really impressed me about the time that I interacted with him was that he came, and I remember in one of our early meetings, Shaukat, you may not recall this, but in one of our early meetings, you started talking to me about your 9-point or 10-point, I can't exactly recall now, action plan. And then you developed this idea into a presentation, a PowerPoint. And I remember you're walking through this action plan. And it was an action plan of which only a small part was devoted to fixing the current problem. And the large part was devoted to how we were going to get to a different level of economic activity and growth on a sustainable basis. And I found that was really a vision that we in the end, we couldn't follow through. You know, you and others tried as best you could, but I would say that is a conversation we need to have. If we can manage to avoid these repeated stabilization distractions, then we can get on to the much more serious business of economic growth and a vision for the economy. So let me end with that and look forward to the comments from Shaukat. And then I look forward also to the comments. And if there are any questions, I'll do my best to try and answer them. Thank you, Nadeem.
Great talk, Masood. Thank you very much. So Shaukat, there you have it. I think.
Thank you very much.
Analogy, just 1 second. Just to use my analogy, to go back repeatedly to the emergency ward is probably a sign of insanity. And I think we have to get over that. And we have to start thinking about how best to fix our own country. What happens is every time a new government comes in, we keep running to them. And we waste all the crisis. And as somebody said, a crisis is too good a thing to waste. So Shaukat, tell me, how do we get out of this mess where we can make our economy grow and not go to the fund again? Go ahead, Shaukat.
Okay, you know, I just don't want to believe that we do not have smart people in this country. You know, with people like Nadeem and Masood and everybody else, you know, advising us, that we do have very smart people. When I just talk to the government people, you know, I talk to, you know, the present government also, you know, I just said that, you know, why don't we look at, you know, the countries around us, how did they just plan and grow on a sustainable basis for 20, 30 years? But I think more importantly, why don't you just look at, you know, our own history and see when were we doing well? And I just go back to the 60s and early 70s and I tell them that we used to be one of those countries which was taking off. Let's see, you know, what was the main area where we did well. And as Masood said, and I totally agree with him, the first thing, you know, we did well was we planned very well. We had a strategic plan. We used to call them five-year plans. But we had a very good planning commission, Dr. Mehboobul Haq, M.M. Ahmed, and others. And we just used to actually then go and, you know, consult everybody, all stakeholders. Everybody would have a buy-in. In today's world, I would say a consensus strategy on economic way forward, which we have been now lacking since the early 70s, since Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto abandoned that model. So first, we have to, as you said, Masood, very well, I had this 9-point agenda. Clearly, it had to be expanded. It had to be worked on. But that was the roadmap. So if you do not have a roadmap to start with, you obviously are going to just go into different directions, you know, and then, you know, you'll fall in a ditch and then come out and again fall in a ditch. So the first thing we need to do is any government over here needs to sit down with the opposition and should have a charter on economy, maybe 6-7 points, but a kind of consensus on economic way forward. So what are our issues? I think if, you know, I have to sit with the opposition, if I were there, they are very clear. Well, first is the fiscal side. And of course, the government does not, you know, collect enough money, and we lose a lot of, you know, money through expenses we should not be, you know, incurring, especially the losses on state-owned enterprises. So first we have to work on that. That's a strategic kind of, you know, a kind of objective we must have, and I think nobody, whether in opposition or in the government, will disagree with that. But then we need to have a proper way of moving on. The IMF programs, what they do is, obviously they bring in, you bring them in and they want to suppress the demand, as Masood was saying, and increase the revenues. All of a sudden, so everybody gets into the implementation mode. So there is no time to design the program, sequence the way, you know, you restructure the, you know, the machinery, and then, you know, move in and look at, you know, which are the easy targets or which are the targets will give you bang on the buck, rather than we just keep talking about expanding, you know, the tax base and etc. But we got to be looking at some of these things in more intellectual manner. Then, of course, we have a problem on our current account. And current account is a straight problem that we do not have enough, you know, exports. And we do not have enough exports because our exports sector is totally screwed up. I mean, we have very few, you know, things to export. Textiles is 62%. And then you have some leather and some sports goods, you know, mini miner. And then, you know, rice. So the very fact that if this is what 220 million people can produce, then we have a problem. Then of course people do not realize. And when I was sitting, you know, in Ministry of Commerce the other day when they were presenting the export way forward, I was really not impressed that they forgot the fundamental problem we have. Exports is in the hands of family businesses in Pakistan. These family businesses do not want to let go the control. The father is the chairman and the elder brother is the managing director, and then the other brother is finance minister, manager, etc., etc. And when, you know, always succession happens because the father dies, then there is obviously disintegration. So then, you know, so the entire industry is disintegrated. So you need consolidation. And for consolidation, we do not have laws. We do not have a bankruptcy law over it. There's no Chapter 11. They've only put in place now Chapter 11. So there was no law to just give you, you know, consolidation. And then the other thing, which is people do not realize, is that the Pakistan export industry has no FDI. There's no foreign direct investment into Pakistan export industry. Unlike China and Malaysia and everybody else who just took their FDI into the export industry, because then those people will bring in more capital and more technology and markets with them. They basically, we have only, you know, our local, you know, family businesses doing exports. So our exports will never grow. It will only grow to the extent of, you know, depreciation in your rupee. And because you are fragmented, you are always the lowest denominator. The outside guy, because you are very small and you cannot, you know, fulfill large orders, they give you, you compete on price because you are a commodity business. So we have to fundamentally rethink exports, and we have to fundamentally rethink industry, because we have to make our industry competitive. And since the nationalization of 1972-73, people have actually stopped investing long-term in Pakistan, in industry. They have just become traders. So you have to go and rejig that, make your industry more competitive so that you can also start producing in Pakistan and reduce your imports. So that is the rethink over there we have to do. So that is one of the other areas we really have to pay a lot of attention. The third, obviously, is your saving and investment rate. You just basically have very low savings and hence very low investment rate. And how the hell can you fund? So what happens is when, you know, you stabilize through the IMF program and you start growing, and your politicians say, oh, we want to grow to 6-7%. You don't have the fundamentals to grow over 6-7% because you do not have the savings and investments, you know, to push. So what you do is you start borrowing, whether domestically or internationally, you start borrowing. And that's when, you know, the whole damn thing busts, you know, after a while. So it's a boom-bust environment. You have to do it yourself. You have to fix your own fundamentals over here. And of course, along this goes in my 9-point work, social reforms. Unless you do not have educated people or healthy people, will not, you know, be good. And if we do not have a very robust financial sector, I mean, you will be surprised to know that, you know, your banking to GDP ratio in Pakistan is 33% only. Now, of that 33%, only 50% is lending, which means your banking sector only supports 16.5% of your GDP. How can that, you know, GDP grow when you do not have financial, you know, support? The financial sector has to be revamped. And my own sense is that all this needs fundamentally starts, you know, with a good plan based on consensus. And then, of course, we need good governance, good implementation. So I'll leave it here.
So there you are, Masood. There are so many things that I'm afraid when you made your presentation, most of these things that Shaukat has mentioned, from industrial organization to ESG reform, to saving the investment, to changing our governance structure, all these things are well beyond the purview of the IMF. So let me just say this and I'll open the floor. Is this not something that the IMF should now stop doing? Maybe the IMF it can't handle this, so maybe the IMF should stop trying to handle everything. And then the IMF also uses this excuse that the World Bank, which is a partner, will help us do what Shaukat is doing, what Shaukat is saying, things like PSE reform, things like getting the energy sector going. But then, as I told you in your office many years ago, the World Bank is not capable of doing it. So we are stuck in the middle. We go from fund program to program, and we cannot do the fundamental reform. And Shaukat is right. Nobody has the time to think that through. In fact, program with the result that we don't have those Mahbub ul Haqs and those people that Shaukat is mentioning. We don't have them anymore. So there's no one to design the program for us, and we are stuck. Every crisis, we get deeper and deeper into the mire, and I don't know what we can do. But we'll let you answer that later. Let me open up the floor, folks. I don't want to hog up the situation. You please go ahead and tell me. Raise your hands and we can open up the mic for you. Whoever wants to take the floor can take the floor. The floor is open, please. Folks, tell me whoever wants to say anything. Just raise your hand and you can come in. You know, there's your raise your hand button. Or you can even unmute your mic and come in.
Okay, can I come in?
Sure. Idris? Is that Idris? No, Manzoor sir. Manzoor sir, go ahead.
Yeah, Manzoor. Okay.
Go ahead, Manzoor.
If I look at the recent programs of IMF, there's too much an unrealistic demand for raising tax to GDP ratio. Last time, they wanted the tax to grow by 45%. I mean, they knew it's not possible. It has never happened. This time, they're insisting on more than 30%, and the economy is going in the negative. Now, what happens on the Pakistani side? Because since they can't raise direct taxes, so they go for indirect taxes. And they move towards imports. And you know, our imports are now almost giving 50% of the revenue. Nowhere else it's more than 15% or something like that. Pakistan, 50%. That curbs our international trade. And as a result, we get nowhere. I mean, in some other countries, IMF tried to reform their trade policies or other things. And in case of Pakistan, they don't look at our trade policy. I mean, they just, you know, lip service, but they're not really doing anything. So that's my question here.
In fact, Manzoor Saab, you will probably corroborate this, since Manzoor Saab is one of our best trade specialists in the country. Masood and Shaukat will bear witness to this. We did, thanks to the IMF helping us, and even the World Bank, we did open up our trade and almost a current account. We opened up very well till about 2003, 4, 5. We got down to a very good situation. Come the 2008 program or 9 program, 2008, I think, we imposed regulatory duties and we imposed some other duties. What is it called? Additional customs duty or something. Yeah. Thereafter, every program, we multiplied them. So we've kind of backed off. And as you said, the whole, Masood, you yourself corroborated with the whole program is focused on import compression. So there, that's part of the problem. So anyway, Idris Khwaja, go ahead. Idris Khwaja, are you there?
Yes, yeah, I'm here. If you allow me, sir, my question is about Charter of Economy that the Shaukat have just talked about.
Okay.
I think this Charter of Economy is something like non-starter. Because every government comes to power with its own priorities and theoretically with its own manifesto. Mm-hmm. And if the government was to sit with opposition, then it may have mm-hmm. to forego its priorities. For example, in the current government case, what would happen to what would happen to the housing program if the government were to sit with opposition? And do we have examples of charter of economic countries?
Anywhere else?
Yeah. Can I answer that?
Shaukat, at the end, we'll answer everything. You know, we'll do it together. Let's collect all the questions and we'll come to you. Okay. Roshan Aziz?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. I think my question is on the trust deficit between the state and, let's say, businessmen and normal people. And this manifests itself in, as a businessman, would I invest for a 5-year horizon when I'm not sure what the next government's going to do or what this government's going to change their policy to in 5 years' time? Who's going to go through the hassle? And as a normal citizen as well, when I want to pay my taxes, people cut corners because they do not trust the state. So what is the way, and this is, I think, the larger point of having some sort of consensus, is the state can have a new social contract, say, or have inculcate trust of the people in them so that there is more consistency in policy and people are trusting of them for investment and taxing and for anything.
Okay. Thank you. Salman Saab? Salman? Mr. Salman, go ahead. Mr. Salman, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me? Hi.
Go ahead. Ji, go ahead. Oh, Salman okay. Raja, go ahead, Salman Raja. Go ahead.
So, Salman Raja, thank you. Well, I was actually hoping to find some reason to be optimistic about our prospects going forward. In the write-up to the session, you've said that we need 8% growth over the next 20 years if we are to provide employment to millions of young people who are going to come into the job market. Now, what I take away from this session is that really it's not about stabilization, as Shaukat Tareen Saab has rightly pointed out. That's a short-term solution to an emergency. What we need ultimately is to diversify our exports to somehow cause our exports to grow if we are to escape the boom-bust cycle. Now, I don't know how this diversification is now going to happen in the time period that we seem to have, and it has to happen very, very quickly. Our population continues to grow at nearly 3%. And the exports that Shaukat Tareen Saab has pointed out is textiles and maybe some leather and then rice. So how do we now create that structure in our industry over the next 5-10 years that enables us to compete internationally and to export? So to my mind, it's really a very bleak situation that we are looking at. We've spent maybe the last 50-60 years not developing the human capital, not developing the infrastructure that would allow us to now diversify and take off. So maybe we need to be thinking of a plan B. Assume that there is going to be no 8% growth over the next 20 years and our population is going to be whatever it is going to be. So what do we do when we don't achieve that 8% growth? What is our plan B and our plan C? And is there a plan that can somehow enable us to raise our productivity, cause foreign direct investment to come in, and enable our exports to diversify and also grow? If that is not the case, where do we go from here?
Okay, great, thanks. I'll tell you what, we got some other people wanting to answer, to ask questions. So can I first get Shaukat and Masood for you to respond to these, and then we'll go to the floor again. So please don't rush off, folks. Let's get them to answer these questions, then we'll come back to you.
Shaukat, okay, you I think... Yeah, chartered economy, you know, when I meant chartered economy, you know, it's obviously, if you look at the manifestos of most of these political parties, whether it is, you know, PTI or PMLN, or even People's Party, on fundamental issues, they have the same, you know, kind of point of view. They all want the government revenues to grow. So nobody is going to be saying that we are not going to grow our exports. Nobody is going to say that we are not going to make our state-owned enterprises more competitive and lose less. You know, there is a difference of opinion between the People's Party and the other two parties on what do you do with those, whether you nationalize them or you don't. But nobody has any problems on actually improving the governance of these, you know, enterprises so that they can lose less. I remember of Habib Bank when I just took over, it used to lose 10 billion rupees and we had stabilized it in 3 years, started making money. Thereafter, obviously, you know, the government then, which is the Musharraf government, privatized it. But even if it was not privatized, it would have kept making money. So what we are saying is, There would be consensus on this, and clearly there nobody was going to say that we are not going to spend more money on health and education, and how the hell do we do that, and raising the savings rate. So I think to say that, you know, there cannot be a political consensus, I think there can be a political consensus. And if you look at, you know, to the east, I think in 1991 Congress, you know, came up with the plan. strategic plan, which is a long-term plan. And successively, the BJP governments came in, they tinkered it a little bit here and there. But fundamentally, they just all followed that. So my own sense is that we could also do the same thing. Now, the other thing which I will, the other thing is the diversification of export base. I think Salman Raja said, you know, made a very pertinent thing. My own sense is that, sir, we have to work on this in you know, out of the box. You have today the opportunity that you are setting up around 27, you know, special economic zones with the help of China and the CPAC. Under CPAC. And that means that you can now invite the Chinese companies who are basically farming out their basic, you know, kind of industry, textile, leather, and others, to other countries like Laos, like Vietnam, and other, even Myanmar. So we have to go and just bring them in and say, here, this is what you have prepared for us. Please come in here, invest over here, export from here. So that will give you a kickstart now, as of now. And then in the meantime, you basically consolidate your existing industry and you start a value adding in those industries. And that by itself will then, you know, kickstart your export growth. You have to think out of the box. My own sense is that, you know, we are putting the cart before the horse. I think we basically have brought in the infrastructure with electricity, everything else. And we do not have these SCZs, you know, functional now. In 3 years' time, when we have to start repaying the Chinese, we actually will not have dollars.
Thank you. Masood?
So just a couple of points. First of all, I think just on this question of whether you have a national consensus on core economic policy. You know, my view is that no country is going to be able to make any sustained economic progress without some degree of assurance to investors and private decision makers about what is the long-term agenda in which they're investing in economic terms. So, I mean, I think if you look, you know, you have a consensus on security policy, you have a consensus on foreign policy, that's cross-party. And actually, I agree with Chokan very much. I had a chance to talk in my previous incarnation with pretty much every finance minister and central bank governor in Pakistan who has been in Pakistan, in office in Pakistan over the last 10 or 15 years. And I asked all of them, you know, what were their core views about the running of the economy? I would say 90% of it is the same. People do have the same agenda. The problem arises that because there is no process by which everybody buys into a common agenda, any government that comes in the office, as soon as it attempts to do something which is difficult, it runs into political problems with this opposition because these are difficult things. You have to go against the wishes of vested interests. Sometimes these interests are actually your own supporters. Sometimes they're the supporters of the opposition party. And so it backs away from it. And the only things that you can get done are the things that are most urgently needed. And that's where the IMF comes in as a helpful stick. You can sort of say, look, you know, I mean, really against this, but the IMF program requires us to do it. Soon as we can get them, and this whole idea that, you know, we have to get rid of them off our backs gives an impression that it is sort of we're doing it for them rather than because we think these are worth doing. And, you know, some of it is no doubt design flaws. I mean, I'm not arguing for that. But conceptually, we have to find a way to build a cross-party consensus on the core elements. And recognize that, you know, people are going to go a little bit on either side of that core when they come in from their party political perspective. Second thing I would say is that if you look around the world, there's one country that I think of as an example on this regard is a country like Morocco. Main export of Morocco for a long time was phosphates and phosphate derivatives. Basically, that's what they used to earn their foreign exchange on. And about 15 years ago, they sort of decided that they wanted to diversify. Phosphate market wasn't going to be very profitable in the long run. It's a commodity. And they looked at various options. And one thing that they came up was they encouraged people to come in and set up automobile assembly and manufacture plants. But it's a different model from the one that exists in Pakistan in terms of how to set up these plants, because what they did is they said they would offer them trained labor, infrastructure, a port that functioned. They created Tangier Med, which is now the biggest port in the Mediterranean, big investment in that. And now Morocco's largest export is automobiles. So Renault is there, others are there. They came there not to go to the Moroccan market, which was somehow protected. That's the sort of model you have in Pakistan, is that, you know, come in and set up a plant here and then we'll give you protection to sell here. And actually, if you look at the economics of it, it's not obvious to me that those cars that are being made in Pakistan are adding a whole lot of value in terms of real economic value. But these cars were being made in Morocco to export to the rest of Europe and go back to Africa. And so this is the being part of a global value chain in that. So I think thinking about what is today's version of industrial policy, and let me just end on this point, which is, you know, people think of industrial policy and you immediately go into two camps. There are those who are ideologically opposed to the very term, you know, industrial policy. Let me give you 75 examples of where it has failed. And there are those who basically are very sort of passionately advocates of it and believe that what it is. Actually, I think every country has industrial policy and every country has some way of supporting. The only question is it sensible? Is it good? Is it an industrial policy that is trying to actually take into account the marketplace of today and the global economy of today? Or is it some, you know, dusted off old industrial policy that might have been relevant or even might not have been relevant in the 1960s and we kind of, you know, market that again? I mean, Nadeem has produced a book, you know, which is kind of like, looking at Pakistan, the vision of Pakistan 2050. That's one vision. We can have a debate about it. We can agree or disagree with it. But here's at least somebody who's laying out a vision of it. And so I guess my point is that we do need to have a debate and a discussion about what will constitute the right strategic approach for us to make progress. In the very near term, one very simple example. Do you know that 95% of the antibiotics that are consumed, sold in the United States, come from China? Okay. The API, 95% of it comes from China. Now, I can say to you with as much confidence as I can say for almost anything else, that 5 years from now, that is not going to be the case. The relationship between the United States and China is worse than it has been in many decades, and is not going to get better in the next few years. And the notion that the United States will rely almost exclusively for its antibiotic supply on one country, and that country would be China, is an excess of globalization in many people's views that needs to be controlled. So I think that's going to change. Now, where will that pharma industry go? Pakistan is a vibrant pharma business, you know, not always reliable in terms of product quality, and you have to do a better job at branding and marketing. But, you know, India is the other big supplier today of pharma. Global supply of generics, 60% between China and India. Now, here's an opportunity. If you wanted to do something in that field, you know, you can think of many more fields. I'm not a pharma specialist, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is the world is changing. It will change. And the sooner we get out of a conversation about, you know, the stabilization bit, which frankly is a complete distraction in my mind from the serious discussion we should be having, the sooner we can start having a national discussion about how we create the conditions to achieve the objectives that Shaukat was laying out.
There you go. Basically, we have to start thinking for ourselves, folks. We have to start developing our own program, not rely on the IMF, not look to the emergency world to solve our problems. So I'll take a second round of questions, if you guys don't mind. Alia, do you want to go first? Alia is gone, I think. Okay, in that case...
No, I'm here.
You are here?
No,
okay,
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Alia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My question is about the non-seriousness about growth. And I know that the basic message that came out of Masood Saab's presentation was that we were, or the IMF program evaluation showed that growth was the factor that was the most off in all program countries. Now, with a weak social sector scenario as we have, how would it sort of galvanize the political will to focus on growth through structural reforms? Because we know that structural reforms are recommended so that they lead to a better growth scenario, and we never end up implementing those structural reforms. We have a fragile political setup, too much infighting, no consensus. So my question is there any evidence that countries which have a weak social sector and they repeatedly go through IMF programs can ever really seriously focus on growth? Thank you.
Great. Imran Zafar.
Hey, hi, this is Musaddiq. I'm using Imran's. Imran is sitting with me.
Go ahead. Senator Musaddiq Malik, yes.
Yeah, thank you. So I'd follow up on what Alia said. I think, one, it would be very helpful if you could help us or share with us some contours of what you call growth policy. Very clearly, exports is an issue, and very clearly, growth is an issue. These are two issues. And we've identified the issues, but no conversation has transpired about what should be the policy that drives growth and drives exports. The second question, which is kind of a follow-up to this, is a bit from the social infrastructure perspective that Alia highlighted, but a little bit more comprehensively from competitiveness perspective. Unless the industry is competitive, there's no way in hell we're just going to discount. What are you going to do? Make dollar rupee parity 500 and then the exports would kick in? Well, the price of electricity would accordingly increase, the price of gas would accordingly increase, all the factor inputs would accordingly increase. At some point in time, some conversation about competitiveness also has to kick in. So what should be the, if you first of all think that competitiveness is at the heart of exports as well as growth, then larger growth policies and then some competitiveness policies. Thanks.
Great. Bakar Saab. Bakar?
Yes, Aswami, sir, to all. I am students of economics department, University of Srogoda. So my question is about the monetary policy of Pakistan of last 1 year.
Okay.
The interest rate, Pakistan ka jo interest rate tha, wo 13.25 tha, agreement aaj se 4 maah pehle. लेकिन अभी वो 5 point less than हो गया हुआ है तो हमने अभी जो previously हमने high maintain रखा interest rate को hot money को capture करने के लिए लेकिन अभी वो interest rate fall कर गया और hot money सारी come back वापस चले गई है तो कौन से हमारे वो plus और negative points थे जो हमने इस monetary policy को adopt करने के बाद attain किए हैं हमारी economic growth के लिए वो कौन सी चीजें कौन से impacts आए हैं हमारी previous monetary policy.
Good question.
Thank you, sir.
Ahmed Pirzada, sir. Ahmed Pirzada.
Ji, mera question related hai.
Ji,
thank you. Thank you for giving me the mic. So my question is to do with, so I want to take the cue from what Masood Saab said, that there are many aspects on which there is significant consensus. So, for example, you have come up with the document, we have come up with the document, a new growth strategy, in which we are talking about better management of urban spaces, civil service reform, and other things, right? Then the following government came, they've also talked about civil service reform. I remember Ehsan Iqbal Saab talking on the need for civil service reform and some of the other things, and they also came up with their own document. The same is also true for, let's say, the current government. We've got Dr. Ishrat, who's basically working on a similar type of agenda, perhaps a bit more different. The same is, we can, so essentially, so what Masood Saab said is right, that there's a lot on which there is consensus, and there's, and all of the parties somehow want to do that. Now the issue is, like, when you go on to do it, then obviously things somehow don't work out. And the reason perhaps why they don't work out is because whenever you will go on to implement these policies, it's going to create some winners, it's going to create some losers. And to be a bit more self-critical, I think we as policymakers or researchers, we don't spend or give, we don't give enough attention to how we can minimize some of those costs, which are going to be there definitely during this transition period. What is it that we can do as far as the policy design is concerned so that this becomes a bit more acceptable to different interest groups which exist in the economy and which happen to lose or win as a result of these interventions?
Good question. Shahid Sattar? Shahid Sattar, can you hear me? Okay, Zubair Faisal Abbasi.
Hello.
Go ahead, Zubair Faisal Abbasi. Oh, Shahid, okay, Shahid, go ahead.
Sir, my question relates to who will bell the cat. We all talk that this should be the policy, that should be the policy, that should be done. But if you look at it, who is actually the policymaker in Pakistan? The policymaker is the bureaucracy. It is also the executioner. It is also the chief executive of all the SOEs in Pakistan. So it all ends and starts with the bureaucracy. Unless you get a handle on that, I don't think any reform of any sort can come about. So how do we start with that?
Okay, great. Zubair Faisal Abbasi Saab.
Thank you very much for taking my question. My point is that some leading economists around the world, like Denny Roderick and others, they have mentioned the issue of premature deindustrialization, and Pakistan is perhaps one of those countries which have gone into premature deindustrialization. So my question to Shaukat Tareen Saab and also to Masood Saab is that, do they see any drive in Pakistan's policy environment towards reindustrializing Pakistan, or at least giving it a push, which actually is a result of intersectoral coordination? By intersectoral, I mean that your financial sector, your science and technology, your trade, your even industrial manufacturing, all these things work together, and then they push the economy or the manufacturing sector towards another level of equilibrium. So do our experts see in near term that Pakistan will ever be able to leapfrog onto the industry 4.0 in near future? And if at all, what would be the drivers? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mahmoud Khalid, last question.
Sir, thank you. My question is from Masood Saab. Since we are talking about IMF, what's his view about the new term which is coined related to the international IMF governance? Because most of the countries which have been under an IMF program are following the conditionalities, so-called, and which reflects in the macroeconomic policies. So does he think that we have to, like, accept it as a new norm, that now we have to live with a global governance which is basically IMF dictated from the conditionalities perspective? Thank you.
Okay, Zahra, you'll get the last question. Zahra Aftab always shows up at the last minute.
Thank you, Dr. Nadeem. My question is very simple. We've been talking about export-oriented growth, but I would like to bring in your thesis about domestic commerce and how Shaukat Tareen Saab is here, how we can champion our domestic commerce. Because in banks, at least in my experience, what happened was, or what happens normally, is that even the banks themselves want to lend to those 20 companies. They don't want to do any risk analysis. And if you do risk analysis for them and tell them these are cartels, they collude, please don't diversify your risk, the corporate guys don't want to do that. So please, can he respond, and can Masood Saab respond?
Okay, go ahead. Shaukat, would you like to respond to the questions first?
Nadeem Saab, my apologies. I have been trying to get your attention for almost...
Raising your hand like, okay, go ahead.
But I didn't know how to, you know. So apologies for this. With your permission, may I ask the final question?
Please go ahead.
Thank you, G. My question was, I think some of it has already been covered, so I'm not going to go into that. Basically, I had, just to give you a bit of background, I was very much agreeing with what Shaukat Saab was saying and what Masood Saab was saying, because I've also been working on the reform side, structural reform side, with the World Bank, where I was heading this ease of doing business and investment climate a project of the World Bank with the Punjab government. And I'm also doing some similar reforms and some access to finance work with the currently with the KP, with Khyber Pakhtunkhwa's Minister for Finance. And I also worked on the industrial policy for the Punjab with the same gentleman who is now the Minister of Finance. At that time, he was a McKinsey partner. And so my organization helped him and we did workshops and all of that. So all of this, what you're saying is very close to my heart, and I've been very much involved in work like this for the past perhaps 3 or 4 years. So a couple of questions. One was that, I'd love to hear both speakers' views on it. One was the aspect of the family business or the elite capture that we speak about and so-called structural reforms and how these are stymied by this elite capture, because almost all policy, I think we make fantastic policy. I think we have brains that in any country would, envy us for. However, that gap between getting those implemented and, you know, this policy may be, you know, stellar, but how do you get it implemented? And there's that real problem of the elite capture and the vested interests. One of the questions earlier was about how even bureaucracy. And I always call it, when we, in the reforms world, I always call it the elephant in the room, you know, that we know what he mentions. So the even the people who are supposed to bring about the reforms need to be reformed, you know, sometimes because they're part of the whole problem. So, you know, I really need, your erudite comments on how perhaps, you know, these things can be done differently. The aspect of, what Masood Saab spoke about planning over optimistic planning, because I was associated with the planning and development department in the Punjab, I was very much part of the PDWP and could see that every year the projections and the plans were very optimistic. They were not achieved. They were sometimes 30% achieved. And yet we would continue making those plans. So, you know, what is this? Is it, and I shudder to say it, but is it something that is being done deliberately that we don't want to recognize that we can't do it? And we like to say this because it sounds good, it's politically correct, or it also enables us to tick, you know, make some tick marks so that we can get more aid and more loans. So there's some, I shudder to say the words, but maybe some, dishonesty or something not quite, you know, ethical about that whole process also. So I'm questioning even the process. The other thing is there's no analysis of actual funds spent. Because I hail from the investment world, and we used to always do an attribution analysis. Okay, so we have a portfolio of projects, which project, which monies are actually attributing to the greatest social or developmental impact. No analysis done. Is that something perhaps, Shaukat Saab in his current role, or Masood Saab, and even Nadeem Saab, your very important role, perhaps you could sensitize governments. I've spoken about it many a times. Perhaps capacity is not there. That's one more thing. The final thing is about this whole concept of, not being... Masood Saab, you spoke about Morocco. Now, Morocco, how they had created the right investment climate, and then eventually automobiles were being exported from there. So the aspect of in the right investment climate being the underlying thing of what Shaukat Saab was saying about, you know, creating the right production, sustainable development, and then perhaps even the exports is very critical. My question is, why can't we do what perhaps Singapore did? Because I worked there, I lived there. You know, they brought expertise from all over the world. You know, they are unhesitant and unapologetic about getting technical assistance, technical expertise. Their government officials will go out of their way, and maybe Masood Saab, you can vie for this.
Give it to them to answer these lots of questions. Yes. Amir Durrani, you have the last question you just put in. After this, no more. And a very quick one. No long speeches, please.
No, I'm not going to make a speech. So I go back to the Charter of Economy, and I need really have two questions. My first one is basically to Shaukat Tareen Saab, which is, and also to Masood, which is that what is the structure, the governance structure of growth that you want, and how do you bring it about in Pakistan? It's pretty much like Chahid's question. My second question is that what if I posit that your example of Morocco, all this thing about giving the right, you know, the talk of competition, the talk of right environment. If we are innately a non-growing economy, and I'm trying to put this in words that economists can understand, but we're innately structured that we don't do this, and all that happens because of giving such reliefs or subsidies.
Maria?
So my question to you is, what if we are that? Then what will you do? Because I think that all this thing about giving subsidies, because, you know, if you look at the first FDI into buses, which is Hino in Pakistan, all they have done is they bought in $2.5 million and hence have enjoyed rents and subsidies till the cows come home. So what do you do in a country like Pakistan then?
Okay, great. Shaukat, would you like to go first?
Indeed, I will go first on a few things. And then, of course, Masood Saab. Firstly, I think, you know, responding to Mossadegh, you know, clearly when we talk about growth, you obviously need to have all the contours for growth, which means you need to have, you know, enough money with the government. You need to have, you know, a higher saving rate so that there is investment in the economy. And for the competitiveness, you know, of the export industry, and so these two things are always what I described in the beginning are fundamentals, which means you've got to collect money from your people who have to pay you taxes. And, you know, you have to grow your saving rates by introducing, you know, a kind of programs, products. You know, one of the product which really grows savings, you know, is the housing business, where people, you know, kind of save long term. You don't have any. So these are the kind of things which the central bank should be just encouraging. But on the competitiveness, firstly, we'll need consolidation. And of course, value addition in your industry. And for that matter, now Chapter 11 is there. So let's set up some large private equity companies. You know, we have these 10 or 11, you know, joint investment companies, Park Kuwait, Park Iran, Park this, Park that, doing nothing. Let them do one thing productive and, you know, set up these private equity companies. They start picking up, you know, some of these smaller companies, consolidate them and start selling them to the, you know, foreign investors at a discount. You bring in FDI, you bring in more competitiveness, you bring in capital and you bring in markets. Secondly, you know, you obviously scale up as I think Masood very rightly said, we are, you know, a nation of 220 million people. We manufacture autos, motorcycles, we manufacture pharmaceuticals and others. When we do it for 220 million people, all we have to do is scale it up, you know, scale it up and then export. But unfortunately, Masood, I found out that these guys, you know, they have this agreement with their, you know, manufacturers, you know, in Japan and others, that they'll not manufacture here and sell overseas. Now, that's a weird policy. I think we should look into these things. But scaling up and then, you know, exporting. That's clearly, you know, what we should be doing. I've already talked about SOZs, you know, on China. And we also talked about the value addition. Now coming down to who is going to bell the cats, the bureaucracy. No, bureaucracy is obviously when we let bureaucracy, you know, rule us. The politicians, you basically should take, you make the policies, and frankly, let the private sector run the goddamn thing. We have to let the private sector take the lead. We should not, the policy making should be with the government only. And that policy making should be with the help of all stakeholders, not just the bureaucrats, the people who are on the ground, people who are actually will be implementing this, which is the private sector. Thirdly, I like to comment on export versus domestic commerce. I think they're not too exclude, they can you know, happen at the same time. Exports has not nothing to do with domestic commerce. As a matter of fact, if you just encourage domestic commerce, then the surpluses from the domestic commerce can be also exported. So and even if we encourage domestic commerce, then we could also have, you know, people just, you know, more and more people visiting Pakistan, you know, frankly, rather than traveling from Pakistan overseas. Lastly, you know, we talked about family businesses and elite capture. I've already talked about that, you know, because we have a structure whereby these guys do not, they are just basically do not allow others to come in. So that is why obviously there is fragmentation in the sector. And chartered accounting, you talk about, you know, the last was why, you know, if it's a non-growing economy, no, why should it be non-growing? If we're doing the right thing on revenue collection, on saving rates, we're doing, you know, on our trade balances and competitiveness of industries, why the hell should we not have a growth? So my own sense is that we cannot only focus on one thing and Pakistan will start growing 6 to 8%. No, I think we'll have to do, you know, as I said, and as Masood said, you'll have to have a strategic economic vision and a plan. And that will be multifaceted. Only then you will achieve a 6 to 8% growth, sustainable over a period of time and all inclusive. Thank you.
So let me...
Go ahead.
Okay, I know we're running out of time, so I'll be very brief now. Look, I just want to make two or three points to end, because I think Shaukatab laid out very eloquently the kind of building blocks that have to be tackled in trying to move forward. And we can have a discussion about which comes first, what's the sequencing, and how to go about it. But what I want to say is first, you know, do you have a constituency for growth in Pakistan? Who are the people that are agitating to see the policies that will get to a higher growth rate? Who are the people that are agitating to overcome the obstacles that stop Pakistan from having a higher growth rate? And, you know, same issue arises with taxes. And you know, I've met a lot of people who would say to me that, you know, the burden of increased taxation falls on the same small number of people who are paying taxes because, you know, they are the ones that are in the net. And I would say they are the ones who need to be out there saying, this is not sustainable for us, you know, and then they should be the ones pushing for the non-filers, the people who don't participate in the process and pay their fair share to come in. So this question of, you know, who will bell the cat, the one thing that's very clear is that you're not going to get anybody from an international organization to bell the cat for you. It's just not what they're able to do, you know. I think this has to be a domestic political movement that drives the vested interests into making the right kinds of decisions. And it comes from a combination of independent thinkers, all of you, many of you, and from the business community and the private sector that has to see that that outcome is there. And the second point I want to make is that it can't be a short-term discussion. So this is inherently a 10-year, 15-year agenda. And that's why it's important to build a cross-party consensus. It's much harder today in a democratic structure where people, parties of different persuasions are competing for office, to build a cross-party consensus on anything than it used to be, you know, where there was broadly a much more guided form of democracy in the world than there exists today. I'm not just talking about Pakistan, but generally. With polarization, it becomes harder and harder. But I think without trying to get people to come around to that, it will be very hard to move forward. And the last thing I want to say is that I think this was a question that was asked by, maybe it was by one of the colleagues, about whether there is going to be now a global governance, which is in the form of the IMF. The IMF has programs in not, at the end of the day, not that many countries. And what is interesting that I watch is that some elements of what is good macro policy, you know, try to control your fiscal deficits to manageable levels, try to keep your exchange rate competitive, try to keep your central bank free of political influence, have a financial sector which is not too protected or too repressed. And, you know, and I would say that in Pakistan, as in many countries where you have a large fiscal deficit, the incentive for the financial sector, for the banks to go and do serious business and find clients is very limited, because they can always lend money to the government directly or indirectly and make a pretty good profit on it and not take much risk. So there are these elements on which there is much more consensus than there used to be. And the markets and rating agencies are much less forgiving of people who deviate from that consensus than used to be the case. So in that sense, yes, there is more of a global constraint within which countries have to operate. But I think at the end of the day, it is the countries that drive their policies that end up using the international system to their advantage, rather than being seeing it primarily as a constraint. So that's what I wanted to leave you with. And thank you again for this opportunity. And thank you, Nadeem, for organizing it. And thank you, Shokas, for all your thoughts and insights also. I much appreciate them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Masood. Thank you, Shok. All I will say at the end is that this is a continuing discussion, and we shall keep both of you informed. The next one is on Wednesday with Adnan Mazrai, who's right here with us, but inshallah, we'll get him on Wednesday with Mifta Ismail, and we'll continue the debate. Thereafter, I'm going to call in a lot of people to talk about this, because I think this is a very important debate. I think we've done COVID for a long time. We need to move into the post-COVID economy. After all, it will end at some point. I'll just end by saying, Masood, you're absolutely right. I think you really hit it on the head. I keep saying this, Pakistan, we are very comfortable. Nobody wants growth. It's a simple fact. Those of us who call so-called elite capture people, who think the elite has captured it, with themselves are the elite, they sit in Synth Club and they say, hey, where's the growth? But they don't want growth for certain. Those who say, who will build the cat, I will also say to them that they are also sort of passing the buck. Because it's not a question of who will build the cat, because they presume they know everything. We've been holding a webinar almost every 2 days and 3 days. And I've invited a lot of people, and I think most of our audience will agree. We have found so many questions that are unanswered. We know next to nothing about the economy. There is no research in the country. Nothing happens. And everything that we do comes from donors. And as you said, Masood, rightly, donors by their DNA. I was on that side. You were on that side. I used to tell, when I left a report in a country, I used to tell my friends there, the friends that I made for you, this report is for my bosses, not for you. So remember, I'm writing for my bosses, not you. Question is, when will this country start thinking, and when will this country start demanding growth? Let's hope. I don't see it yet. But thank you, folks. Thank you very much. We shall take it up Wednesday. In fact, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, we have a webinar on investment. We'll take up the issue of investment. So please join us tomorrow morning at 11. Thank you, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.